You've joined us on week two of a four-week series we're doing looking at what the church is. So the word church is used in so many different ways to mean so many different things. But what we really want to do in this series is just unpack a little bit about what does God say through the Bible the church is? What is the church? We started this a couple of weeks ago, and really then I was just trying to lay a few kind of foundations in place of what does the Bible say the church is. So the first thing I was emphasizing was that the church is God's project. So God's great plan for humanity is to call a people to himself, who he will dwell with. He will be their God. They will be his people. This was his intention in creation, to create a people who could be with him. This was his intention throughout the Old Testament as he called a people to himself. And now that's his intention through the church, to call a people to himself. The church is not something that like a few people are into. It's not something that I just happen to be into. It's God's great plan for the world to find a people, call them to himself. He will be their God. They will be his people. So that was the first kind of pillar we were putting in place. And the second pillar we were putting in place is the church is made up of people who put their trust in Jesus. That's fundamentally what makes the church. The church is made up of the people who have put their trust in Jesus. The church is not people who kind of get there by attendance or by good works or by a background or by upbringing or by ethnicity or anything like that. The church is the people of God that God calls to himself, and those people are people who put their trust in Jesus. And then the third pillar we were putting in place was that the church is then expressed in local congregations. That the word literally means gathering. Like that's what the word means. That's translated as the word church in our Bible. So when it talks about the church in Corinth or the church in Rome, all it means is the gathering of Christians in those locations. So they were kind of the pillars we were putting in place. The church is God's project. It's not simply something that some people are into. The church is made up of people who've put their trust in Jesus. And the church is then expressed in local congregations. If you weren't here a couple of weeks ago, then you can pick it up online if you want to have a listen. It would be helpful just to have that in place because I don't want to spend the next kind of 3 weeks just repeating what I said 2 weeks ago. So if you do have a chance just to tune in, that might be helpful for you for the rest of this series. Now, I want to take you back to 19-year-old Ben Parker. So this is now 20-something years ago, 2002. 19-year-old Ben Parker moves to Sheffield. Because I'm about to start studying history, studying in the loosest possible sense of the word, history at Sheffield University. And so I turn up and I go to Stevenson Hall of Residence. There's about 500 students there, and I'm in F block. Now, F block is made up of six floors with three rooms on each floor, and it's all guys in F block, so they kind of block it, so the F block was all guys, E block was all women, that's just the way they organized it. So I was in a block with all guys, 18 guys on a block there. And so one of the issues we had was that within these 18 guys in my block, four of them were called Tom. And so you inevitably have to give them nicknames, and you've got to do it quite early because, like, before you really know them. And so they get really bad nicknames. So one of the guys got the nickname Bog Floor because he happened to be on the floor which the toilets were on. It turned out that actually three of the floors had toilets on, but it didn't matter by that point because the name had stuck. And also, he was really irritated by this name, which at 19-year-olds is a key to me. I'm going to call you this for the rest of your life. So anyway, I want to tell you a bit about Bog Floor. A group of guys at uni. What are you going to do when you first get there? Well, one of the things you're going to do is you're going to arrange to go out and have a kick around, right? So lots of us were into football. Not all of us, but lots of us were. So we're like, hey, let's get a football. Let's go and have a kick around. So a few of us went out and we had a kick around, and it turned out that a few of us were all right at football. So we're like, hey, let's make a team. So we formed this team. And we entered into a couple of leagues. We made a five-a-side team and an 11-a-side team. And we're like, let's enter a couple of leagues. So we entered a couple of leagues and we started playing football. But like like so many teams, we had the problem that we just didn't have a goalkeeper. If you've ever played football, you'll know this is often a problem because finding people who are willing to just stand in goal is like hard to find. So we didn't have a goalkeeper. So anyway, we're out one day and Bogfloor says to me, he says, "Oh, I'll go in goal for you." Now, he's a tall guy, quite well built. I looked at him and thought, I bet he's quite a good keeper, actually. But it's one of those, you're kind of slightly nervous. You're like, what if they're absolutely rubbish? Like, I can't say yes without seeing them. So I'm like, hey, come out and play a game of football with us. So he comes out to play with us. And what transpires is that he is a lot better than all of us, like by some considerable margin. Like, he's played at a much higher standard than any of us. And if he were to play on our team, not only would he be the best team player on our team, he would probably be the best player on the pitch by some margin. And so we're now left with this quandary, because none of us want to go in goal, but it's an absolute waste to get your best player and stick him in goal and just be like, hey, you just go in goal there. Like, it turned out like we have to play him in centre mid. We just have to. He's the best player. He's got to play there because he's going to run the game from there. He's going to win us more games playing in that position. Now, why am I telling you this story? I'm not entirely sure, but I'm going to make a tenuous link. And the tenuous link goes a little bit like this, which is sometimes I think with the church, we're in danger of failing to realize and make the most of its full potential. We're in danger of seeing the church and seeing all that God has planned for it, but then sticking it in goal, like sticking it on the sidelines, in the background, failing to see and experience all that it could be. You see, we're doing this series on the church because I think we run the risk of missing out on all that God intends the church to be. I think God's intention for the church is so much greater than we realize. And because of this, I think we're in danger of undervaluing the church and then failing to allow it to be what God intends it to be. It's like us taking our best football player and putting him in goal. Sometimes I worry that we take God's great gift of the church and just put it in the background. We leave it kind of untapped. We assume that what it is, however you've experienced the church in your life so far, we assume that that's all it could ever be. Failing to realize just how much potential there is in the church. If there's one thing I'm looking for from this series, lots of people have asked me kind of, what are you hoping for from doing a series on the church? What are you hoping for from these 4 weeks? One of the things I'm hoping for is that we would be more ambitious about what the church is and what the church could be. It's one of my great goals, is that we'd just be a little bit more ambitious about it. And then for us together to pursue God's radical vision for his people, which he sets out in the Bible. Here's what I'm going to try and do over these next 3 weeks, and I'm going to do one of them this week, but I'm going to try and set out for you some of the things the Bible says about the church, so that you can see how radically different the way God thinks about the church is to how we so often do. And perhaps one of the places where we can see this most radically is in Revelation 21. I'm going to put the verses up here, assuming this works. It literally, we tested it before and it was working. So, Jim, you're going to have to click for me. If you can see it up there, then great. If not, it's on page 1249 on the Bibles on the table. So if you'd rather have it in front of you in natural Bible, then you can find it on 1249. We're going to be here for a little bit, then we're going to be somewhere else. I'll put the other bit up there. Revelation 21, for those of you who aren't that familiar with the Bible, it comes right at the end of the Bible. And it tells the story of what will happen at the end of time. It describes the world which Jesus is going to usher in when he returns. It is full of poetic language, full of symbolism, but the world it describes is absolutely incredible. Let me just read a few verses from Revelation 21 for you now. I'm going to read verses 1 to 4, and then I'm going to skip a bit and just go down to 9. So this is how it reads. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And I'm just going to skip down to just verse 9. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. What a wonderful passage that is. So some of you who've been around church for a long time will have heard it many times, and it is one of those passages which when I hear it, it so often brings a tear to my eye. The thought of that world with no more pain and no more mourning and no more death. The tender picture of God himself wiping tears from our eyes. But what we often miss as we read it, or what I often have missed, I think, is that this is a passage about the church. You see, this the image of the New Jerusalem, that's a picture of the people of God. Of God dwelling, the people that God dwells with, the church. They will be his people and he their God. You know, the church are the people of God. And in verse 12 14, and 14 at the end of this section, you get it kind of really explicitly pointed out that this is talking about the church, where it says that this kind of people are made up, built on the foundation of the 12 tribes, the Old Testament people of God, and the 12 apostles, the New Testament people of God, the church. This is all about the time where God and his church are finally united. And John does one of his favorite tricks in this section, which is he does the classic mixing of metaphors. He does it earlier in Revelation, if you've ever read it. He's talking about Jesus. And he says at that point, look, see the Lion of Judah. And so he's kind of set Jesus up as this lion, this strong figure who is going to defeat enemies and protect his people. And so he turns and he looks at the lion, and then it reads like this. It says when he looks, he says he actually sees a lamb that's been slain. He's like, look, see a lion. And then you turn and you see a lamb. You're like, oh, wait a minute, I thought we were seeing a lion. And his point is that Jesus is both the lion who wins the great victory for his people and defeats his enemies, but he's actually also the lamb who was slain so that we could be forgiven. He does the same here. You might have noticed it. He says in this section, he says, here, come look at the bride. Look at the bride of the lamb. Come look at Jesus' wife. And yet when he looks, what does he see? He sees a city. You're like, this is strange. I thought we were going to see a bride. But that's because what John's doing here is he's saying the church is both the great building project of God where he's going to make his dwelling, but it's also the bride of Christ. And that's really where I just want us to camp out this week. I just want to just spend a little bit of time this afternoon thinking about what it means for the church not only to be this city, this dwelling place of God, but also to be the bride of Christ. Or to put it a different way, to be Jesus' wife. I wonder if you ever think of the church in that way. I wonder if you ever look around the church and think, you know what this church is? It's the bride of Jesus. It's Jesus' wife. Maybe you've literally never heard that idea before in your life. You've never come across this. You've never thought about it. And it's an entirely new idea for you. Well, if that's the case, you would never look around this room and go, you know what this is like? It's like the bride of Jesus. Like it would never be where your mind would go. You would never have just sat here and come up with, off your own back, you know what Grace Church is like? It's like Jesus' wife. That's just not where you'd have gone. Maybe for others of you, you've heard this idea before. You've been around churches, you've read this passage, you've read other passages that talk about the church as the bride of Christ. You've come across it before, but maybe you've never been quite sure what to do with it. If I'm honest, I think that's probably where I've been quite a bit. It's such an abstract idea as to be like, does it have any practical use at all? Like, what does it actually mean beyond just a concept? Is there any substance? Is there any practical use to us seeing the church as the bride of Christ? Well, what I think it does, at least in part, is it completely shakes up what we think church is and what we think it means to be part of a church. And to look at what it does, I just want to go to another passage, which will come up on the screen now. It's from Ephesians 5. It's probably the other main passage which talks about this image. And in this passage, Paul really unpacks what it means for the church to be Christ's wife. Now, this is a passage that is often used to teach about marriage, about what marriage should look like. And I think that's helpful. I think that's certainly part of what Paul's intention was in writing it, helping people who are married think through what does it mean to be a husband, to be a wife. But it is interesting that at the end of it, he specifically says, oh, actually, I've been talking about Christ and his wife this whole time. I've actually been talking about Christ and the church. Whilst it is legitimate to use it for that, what I want to do this time is think, what does it teach us about what it means for the church to be the bride of Christ, to be Jesus' wife? Let me read it to you, and then I'm just going to pull out four things. It reads like this. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. When you look at Grace Church, I wonder what you see. Like, maybe just look around the room now. I mean, you can do it really obviously. You can just like take a little glance. I don't mind. However you want to do it. Maybe don't stand up and like walk around because it might be a bit distracting. But whatever you do, just look around. Like, what do you see? What do you see in this room? Maybe you see a group of friends. You look around this room and you just see people who you love and you care for. People you've known for many years. People you enjoy hanging out with. Maybe that's what you see as you look around this room. Maybe you look around this room and you see a group of people you're just starting to get to know. You look around this group and you see some smiling faces and you think, oh, maybe I'd like to get to know them, or maybe I'd like to get to know them. Maybe that's what you see. Maybe you see a group of middle-class Hartlepoodlians. Maybe you see a weird mix of people, some of whom you like, some of whom you just don't get at all. Maybe you look around this room and you see a group of people who take Jesus far too seriously. Or maybe you look around this room and see a group of people who don't take Jesus nearly seriously enough. Like, what do you see as you look around this room? Who are these people and why are we here? I wonder how you describe it. How do you describe Grace Church? Someone asked you about it. Young, old, trendy, not so much. I don't know. Like, what would you? How would you describe it? Now, I guess we'd all describe it slightly differently. If I went around and asked you all, I'd probably get as many different answers as there are people in the room. But here's the amazing thing is, do you know what Jesus sees when he sees Grace Church? He sees his bride who he loves. I think that's the most incredible idea. That's what Jesus looks at. He's looking at us right now as he sees us. He sees his bride who he loves. That's where Paul starts in verse 25, just as Christ loved the church. Jesus loves the church. Not in a kind of general, you know, I love all of humanity kind of way. Not in that kind of way. The way we might talk about, you know, I love all people. No, he loves the church in a very specific way. He loves the church like a husband loves his wife. He adores his church. He looks at his church and he smiles. He would do anything for his church. In fact, we're told what he does. He dies for it. He loves his church and lays down his life for it. Jesus doesn't begrudgingly love Grace Church because he has to, because that's his job. Now, Jesus is like a husband who, out of all the people in all the world, chose the church as the person he was going to love. Imagine if you were describing to somebody what it means to be a wife. And imagine if you started doing that by describing the role. You know, what's the role of a wife? Imagine if you start describing, going, you know, well, what it means to be a wife, it is doing a whole load of stuff. It involves like owning a house, maybe, looking after a house, maybe, going to work and earning some money, possibly. It involves caring for children if you have them. It involves the normal things of life, sleeping and eating and showing hospitality. Any number of things which you may or may not do as a wife. Imagine if that's how you describe to someone who had no idea what it meant to be a wife, what it meant to be a wife. Would that be a satisfactory description of a wife? It clearly wouldn't be. You'd have to start your definition of a wife by saying that being a wife involves having a husband who loves you, who has committed to always loving you, and whom you love and will always love. Now, all those other things might describe some of the things that a wife may or may not do. They're not necessarily incorrect, but they're just not fundamentally what a wife is. But isn't that so often what we do with the church? We describe it by describing what it does. You know, the church is a group of people who sing songs and look at the Bible and share life, forgetting that whilst this might accurately describe some of the things we do, it misses who we are. The church is the people who Jesus loves. That's our foundational identity. Everything we do is meant to flow out of knowing the love that Jesus has for us. Knowing that he loves to be with us. He's never fed up with us. He's never had enough of us. He always wants our best. That he smiles at the very thought of us. What does it mean for the church to be the bride of Christ, to be Jesus' wife? Well, it means that we're loved by Jesus. But it also runs the other way, right? The church is the people who Jesus loves, but it's also the people who love Jesus. The church is not primarily a social club or organization. It is a bride who loves Jesus. Why do we come together and sing songs declaring how much we love Jesus? Why do we talk to Jesus in prayer? Why do we love to hear him speak to us through his word? Why do we try to obey him and please him? Well, I don't know. Why does a wife tell her husband that she loves him? Why does she enjoy talking to him and listening to him? Why does she look for opportunities to please him? Well, surely the most basic reason for that is because she loves him. Because she loves him. When I say to you, hey, I'm going to, Sarah's my wife, by the way, for those of you who don't know. But when I say, hey, I'm going to spend this evening with Sarah, no one goes, why are you doing that? Like, that's a strange way to spend your evening. No, it's obvious I'm going to spend an evening with Sarah because I love Sarah. And we love spending, when I say, oh, I'm going out for a walk with Sarah, people don't go, oh, there must be some sort of health kick. Like, they understand what it means. I'm going to go on a walk with Sarah because I love spending time with Sarah. I love walking with Sarah. I do it because I love her and I want to spend time with her. The church is Jesus' wife, which means that he loves us and we love him. So here's just a really obvious question for me to ask at this point. Do you love Jesus? That is a question that feels uncomfortable to many of us. feels a little bit cringe. I feel a little bit cringe saying it. I don't talk about loving people very often. It took me like years to tell Sarah that I loved her. That's just the way I am. But at its most basic level, that is what it means for the church to be the bride. It means that we know and enjoy Jesus' special love for us. We experience his kindness towards us, the joy that he feels regarding us. And it means that we love him, that he is special to us, that he is the one we adore, the one who the very thought of brings a smile to our face, the one we have committed to, the one we enjoy, the one we love to please. I just want to make this as clear as I can. This is a long way away from the church being a set of meetings and attendance and orthodox beliefs. Now, don't get me wrong, I love meetings and I think we should go to them and I believe in orthodoxy. I believe in all of these things. But this is a long way from this. This is love. You know, this is the love that Jesus has for you and the love that you have for him. That's what it means for the church to be the bride. August 2005. I want you to cast your mind back. I know some of you weren't born, but you know, those of you who were born, like, what were you doing in August 2005? Some of you were watching the greatest Ashes series that has ever happened in the history of cricket. Some of you were at school, college. Some of you were on holiday. It's August. Some of you have been away. A momentous thing happened to me in August 2005. Now, you're all probably sitting there thinking, obviously he got married, which I did in August 2005. I had to get there at some point in this talk. I had to go back to my own marriage. But that wasn't the momentous thing that happened. The momentous thing that happened in August 2005, I mean, it was the momentous thing that happened, but it's just not the momentous thing that happened. I'm not going to, you know, you get that. The momentous thing I want to talk about that happened in August 2005 was it was the last time that I paid for a haircut. So it's one of mine and Michelle's favorite questions in CAP meetings, because one of the things they have to do is put a hairdressing budget in place. And I'm always like, that should be zero, guys. But anyway, so it's the last time I don't think I actually did pay for it. I think my parents paid for it. It's the last time money changed hands in order for my hair to be cut. That's what happened in August 2005. Now, why did that happen? Well, it happened because, as I've previously alluded to, I was about to get married, and my hair was unacceptable for that kind of event. I it was a one-time deal. I'm willing to pay someone to make this look better. But that wasn't all I did. I did lots of things. You know, I bought a new suit. I bought the comfiest pair of shoes I've ever owned. I got myself ready for the wedding day, because that's part of the fun, right? Part of the fun of the wedding is trying to look your best. You know, some of us are more limited in the ceiling we can get to in that. But, you know, we'll do what we can with what we've got. So that's part of the fun of the wedding, right? Everyone's getting dressed up. And specifically, the bride's job is to make sure she outdresses everyone else. Or more to the point, everyone else's job is to make sure they don't outdress the bride. But that's the fun of it, right? It's the one time in your life where you can wear truly outrageous, over-the-top clothes, because it's kind of understood that that's what you do. Clothes you will probably only wear once in your entire life. Now, this is the image which Paul conjures up for us in this section. Look at what he goes on to say. So we've talked about Christ loving the church. We've done like four words so far. So we've got a bit of ground to cover now. But Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. The image here is of Jesus getting the church ready for the great wedding day that we read about in Revelation 21. That's the image here. He's preparing the bride so that she looks her best for the wedding day, so that she can be radiant without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish. What does it mean for the church to be the bride of Christ? It means that we are now, right now, in the process of being made beautiful, ready for our wedding day. Now, we need to hear this right. This is not primarily Jesus making me or you as individuals beautiful for our wedding day. This is Jesus making the church beautiful, ready for our wedding day. What is Jesus doing right now in Grace Church? He is making us beautiful. He is making us holy and blameless. He's making us, as a church, more loving, kinder, more generous, more forgiving, more joyful, more thankful, more peaceful, more united, less divisive, less argumentative, less critical, less malicious, less untruthful. That's what he's doing right now. He's preparing us for our wedding day so that we can be presented holy and blameless, without blemish. And notice how he's doing it. He's cleansing us by the washing with water through his word. That's the image. He's picking up the image of the people in weddings at that time getting washed, having a bath before they went to their wedding ceremony. He's picking up that image and saying, this is what I'm doing right now to you through the word. That's the process we're now involved in. That's why we gather around God's word. That's why we open the Bible and we read it and we teach it. That's why we sing songs full of truths of God's word. That's why we wrestle to understand it. That's why we seek to be transformed by it. That's why we look to speak of it and think on it and obey it. The bride of Christ is being prepared for its wedding by his word. I've just got one thing more to say, and then I'm going to wrap this up. Because Paul then changes the image a little bit. Because we're not just the bride awaiting our wedding day. We are also the wife already being cared for by Jesus. Look at the image of verse 29. After all, no one ever hated their body, but they feed and care for their body just as Christ does the church. Here the picture shifts. We're no longer looking forward to our wedding, but we are the wife being fed and cared for by our husband. What does it mean for us to be Jesus' wife? Well, it means that Jesus feeds us and cares for us. And again, remember, this is not what he does for us individually. This is what he does for the church. He feeds and cares for us. By that, I mean that it's in the context of the church that Jesus feeds and cares for us. As we live lives together, Jesus feeds us and cares for us. As we care for each other and meet each other's needs, Jesus is feeding and caring for us. As we sing songs together, Jesus is feeding and caring for us. As we seek to proclaim his excellencies to a watching world, Jesus is feeding and caring for us. As we do the things we do as a church, as we do church training, as we meet in life groups, as we show interest in each other, as we remind each other of the love that Jesus has for us, as we encourage each other, all of these things, Jesus is going to keep on feeding and caring for us as his wife through those things. I started this week by suggesting that we might be in danger of undervaluing the church. Of leaving it on the sidelines rather than really letting it be all that God intends it to be in our life. And perhaps it's here in the description of the church as Jesus' bride that we see just how limited our view of the church can sometimes be. Over the past year, I've been watching through the sitcom Parks and Recreation with my kids. I've seen it all before, but it's great when you've got kids who are old enough, gives you an excuse to watch the things you love again. And so we're watching through it. And we just watched an episode recently where two of the characters, April and Andy, get married. And it's kind of like an impromptu thing. They decide like the day before they're going to get married, and everyone, but specifically Leslie, thinks it's a terrible idea. You know, she's very disapproving of this. She's looking at it, she's like, this is not, we've got to stop this wedding. But what's really interesting is, as the episode unfolds and the wedding happens, she sort of just gets swept along by it. She can't help but smile as she sees these two people coming together. You know, she might think it's too quick. She might think it's unwise. She might think all those things. But when it's actually happening, she can't help but smile. She can't help but see it as sweet and hopeful and attractive. And I think in some ways, I was thinking as I was watching this episode, that so much sums up our culture as we think about marriage. Because whilst we might have eroded marriage in so many ways, while we might continue to create loveless marriages, whilst we might keep tearing marriages apart, whilst we might talk as if we think marriage is outdated and unimportant, that dream, the dream of romantic love, the dream of someone who will always love you no matter what, the dream of someone who understands you, the dream of someone who will share in your triumphs and failures, the dream of someone who will take your breath away, the dream of someone you will always be comfortable around, the dream of someone you will trust entirely, the dream of someone you will build your life with, that is still a powerful dream. And however much you might want to be cynical about it, it seems to me that people still are drawn to it. And it's a dream that continues to consume so many of our lives. Many single people spend their lives dreaming of meeting Mr. or Mrs. Right who will complete them and finally make them experience all the things they dream of. Many married people become disillusioned when it doesn't live up to it. They dream of making their marriage so much more. They get divorced, they try again. Here's what I think it means for the church to be the bride of Christ. I think it means that the fulfillment of our romantic dreams will not be found in meeting Mr. or Mrs. Right. Your dream of the perfect marriage will not become a reality. Your dream of making your marriage all you hope it will never quite be complete. Just to make this personal, my marriage to Sarah will never fully fulfill my deep desire for that kind of relationship. Rather, it will at its best act as a beautiful picture, act as an incredible token of the relationship that I will enjoy as part of the church with Jesus. I think that's where this takes us. We can talk about this more in life groups. I'm very happy to discuss it during the week. But I think this is where it takes us. It's through being part of the church that you can look forward to that wedding day where you will actually know what it is to be loved by someone who will never stop loving you. Where you will actually know what it is to know someone who fully understands you and yet still delights over you. On that day where you will finally share all of your life with someone and they will share it all with you. It is on that day that you will see someone whose beauty will take your breath away every time you see them. It's on that day you will finally find someone who you will always trust entirely and always be comfortable with. It's on that day you will finally be with someone where you can build a new and perfect life in a new and perfect home. You want to know how radical I think the Bible's vision for church is? It's so radical that it says even your deepest romantic longing will ultimately be fulfilled, not in marriage, however beautiful your marriage might be, and I hope it is, but in being part of a church which loves Jesus and is loved by Jesus and will one day enjoy the wedding and the life we long for. I'm not sure that's how any of us think about church very often. But I think that's what it must mean for the church to be the bride of Christ. I'm gonna stop here. I'm going to give us a time of quiet. I'm going to just suggest that maybe there's a few things you could do during this time. Maybe it's just a time for you just to reflect on Christ's love for you. Maybe some of you come here feeling like Christ tolerates you. At a push, he'll put up with you. And you've forgotten that Jesus smiles when he sees you, when he looks at his church, at those people who've come to him through trusting in Jesus. He doesn't begrudgingly love them, but he adores them. Maybe that's just where you need to just sit on for a few minutes. Maybe some of you just need to think of the beauty of Christ. Think of his faithfulness. Maybe you've been hurt and let down so many times, and you just need to reflect on the faithfulness of Jesus who will always love you and allow that to stir your affections for him, to find yourself loving him afresh. Maybe some of you need to think about what it looks like for Jesus to feed you and nourish you and care for you. as your husband. Or maybe some of you need to think, what did it look like for Jesus to make me beautiful for that wedding day? What is the work that Jesus is doing in me as part of this church right now? What's he doing in Grace Church? What's he doing in our life? I'm going to give you a few minutes of quiet to think on that, to pray on that, to go where you need to and to hear what God has to say to you, and then we're going to sing together.